following programming is sponsored by Clean and Sober Media. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
If you need immediate help, please call the National Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. Welcome to Clean and Sober Radio, brought to you in part by Recovery Centers of America, the nationally recognized leader in drug and alcohol treatment. Using proven, evidence-based treatment, including 24/7 medically supervised detox, inpatient and outpatient options, you'll receive exceptional care from an expert team of master-level clinicians, physicians, nurses, and staff using 12-step methodology and medications. Jefferson University Hospitals and Thomas Jefferson University, providing excellent clinical and compassionate care in the Philadelphia region. A proven leader in healthcare and education since 1825. And Acadia Healthcare, with locations on the East Coast. Acadia maintains a standard for excellence in the treatment of behavioral health and addiction concerns. And now, here are your hosts, Gary Hendler and Mark Sigmund.
Hey, welcome to Clean and Sober Radio. I'm Gary Hendler, along with my co-host, Mark Sigmund. We really appreciate you joining us today. Clean and Sober Radio features real people with real stories about addiction to drugs and alcohol. And we'd like to thank some of the great radio stations across America that are broadcast our show. WWDB in Philadelphia, WWNN in Boca Raton, Florida, WHFS, Tampa, Florida, and KDWN in Las Vegas, Nevada. Mark, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing great, Gary. Another week gone down, huh?
That's right. What do you got for us in the news?
Oh, got some very interesting news. First article, researchers are revisiting a drive to develop a vaccine against addictive drugs. It's been nearly 50 years since a group of researchers in Chicago reported an extraordinary finding. They created a vaccine against drug addiction. But when they injected monkeys with a compound they developed, one designed to coax the immune system into fighting addictive drugs as if they were pathogenic invaders, the animals stopped seeking drugs.
Okay. All right. They're injecting monkeys?
Well, yes. But here's the thing.
Well, let me ask, can these monkeys go to rehab also?
I don't think so. They haven't started a rehab for monkeys yet. But
what's the thing?
Here's the thing is that basically what these vaccines would do is they would teach the immune system to attack the opioid so it wouldn't cross the blood-brain barrier.
Okay.
And this could be an amazing thing.
That is amazing because, as I understand, the closest thing to humans are monkeys, right?
Yes. And they're in a phase one trial right now. And this could be the stuff of the future.
Good. Interesting. What else you have?
So adolescents – this is sad. Adolescents and young adults lost more than 1.25 million years of life due to drug overdoses in a four-year period. Researchers at Ohio State University found adolescents and teenagers ages 10 to 19 cumulatively lost these years of life between 2015 and 2019. So it's 1.25 million years of life.
Wow, that's really...
Isn't that insane?
Yeah, that's horrible.
Yeah, you never think of it from that level. And this is between 2015 and 19, and now it's going up even further in terms of the amount of deaths each year. I mean, the young adults are getting devastated.
Yeah. Are you seeing that at work?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, a younger demographic?
I have for quite a while. I mean, beginning with the perks... and then moving on to heroin. We see it all the time. And it's really tough because if you're young, imagine being hooked on heroin at 21 years old. I mean, it's very hard for them to get clean, and a lot of them are dying, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's the horrible reality of what this world is going through right now as far as the addiction. Listen, we're going to take a break in a little while. When we come back, our guest is Sarah Colvin. We're happy that you're here, Sarah. And Sarah is in long-term recovery and relapsed like a lot of people do and ended up doing a lot of criminal stuff to get money for dope, which a lot of us, I'm going to include my do. And, but she's back. She's back and she's given back and she's been sober for a while. So when we come back, We're going to start our interview with Sarah Colvin.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
If you're struggling with alcohol or drugs, Recovery Centers of America can help. RCA's local inpatient and outpatient programs are founded on science and delivered with heart from an expert, caring team who will inspire and guide you every step of the way. Call 1-888-RECOVERY now to speak with a treatment advisor. At RCA, you'll be in a community that builds connections and fosters support from peers and RCA's team of medical professionals and recovery support specialists. At RCA's state-of-the-art campuses in Devon, PA, and Mays Landing, New Jersey, they tailor your treatment to you and also offer specialized programs for patients with history of trauma, for patients who have achieved recovery but are experiencing a relapse, for young adults, adults 50 years and older, a confidential program for first responders and military, and a faith-based program. RCA answers the phone and accepts patients 24/7. And because it's local and in-network with insurance providers, treatment is affordable and accessible. Don't wait. Call 1-888-RECOVERY. Recovery today.
Hi, I'm Billy J. Kramer, and I listen to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Hey, we're back. Sarah, first of all, thank you so much for coming on. You know, it's not easy to, air all our dirty laundry. And give you a lot of credit for it. And that's part of your recovery, of you giving back. Because by you telling your story today on this show, you're going to help a lot of people.
I'm really happy to be here.
So welcome to the show.
Thanks.
All right. So, I keep on making you feel better and saying, like all of us, you became a bad kid. All right. So tell me how your childhood was. Did you grow up in a nice, loving family? Because I always like to know what makes us do things that we shouldn't do. Is it environmental? Is it, is it psychological? How was your childhood?
Or is it both?
Yep.
Yeah. So I had a really amazing, stable, Catholic-based, strong, supportive mother, and I had an unpredictable alcoholic father. So that's the story of my childhood. I did find that regardless of my external conditions, I always had a weirdness inside of me, just something that was always like, I'm different, I'm not the same, I don't fit in, that dis-ease within myself. I always had it, and I don't know if maybe it was exacerbated by my circumstances, my unavailable father, my unpredictable father, but I also had a very strong, stable, loving mother. And I'm the oldest of four. We had everything we needed. We all played sports. We all went through Catholic school. We all had a really good relationship with our grandparents. A lot of love, a lot of fun, and also some unpredictability with an alcoholic father and what that creates in a child.
Yeah, I can only imagine what that creates. I didn't grow up with that problem, but the psychological effects, Mark, you better speak on this. It can travel with you your whole life.
Yeah, I mean, basically what we're talking about is trauma. Any child that has a parent that's in active addiction is going through trauma, and they're going to carry that, and they're going to carry that well into their life, throughout their life, and it's going to have long-term effects. I mean, you sit there and you watch your father drinking, and I don't know, was your father around a lot, or would he come home drunk? Was there any abuse in the house?
He was around. He broke his back. My dad broke it. So my dad is deceased. He passed away at 60 years old, late stage alcoholism, the conditions that surround that, pancreatitis, COPD, anxiety, all that, late stage alcoholism.
I just want to interrupt. Our listeners and viewers, listen to what Sarah just said. Her dad passed in the early 60s because of an addiction.
He did.
It's not just something you hear about.
Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Sarah. I'm sorry.
Yeah, he lost a lot of his life. But he was always there. He broke his back when I was 8 years old. He was an exterminator, and he fell out of a roof. And at that point, he deteriorated. Our family deteriorated. It was a crucial time. I was in second grade. He never worked again a day in his life. He got on Social Security disability and was home all the time just drinking. I think the hardest part for me was that I didn't know what to expect. Sometimes he was this happy, joyous dad who wanted to take us out for ice cream and he loved us all so much. And sometimes he was angry and we would have hiding places when he would scream. And it was hard, I guess, not knowing it was never stable. It was never a sense of security or stability because I didn't know what dad I was going to get from day to day. And I believe we carry that into our future. But I also believe for me, the 12 steps have healed a lot of that stuff and have allowed me, before my father died, make complete amends with him and love him for all that he was and all that he wasn't.
Oh, that's a great story. You know, the story about not knowing the volatility of a parent. We've had several really famous people on talk about they didn't know which father they were going to get when he came through the door. And that must be a very unsettling and scary experience for somebody, especially so young.
I think what happens is that you become a quick – you get very adept at reading people, like, immediately. So I know how to respond to the way you are, like, immediately. And that is – yeah, not always the healthiest is that I have to read people super quick. Like, as soon as my dad would walk in the room, just his energy, his mannerisms, the way he would walk, I would just know if I have to be quiet or if everything's going to be okay. Yeah. You know?
Did your mother cover up for your father?
My mother wasn't – I would say she was an enabler. Not that she covered up. She would just say, one day at a time. Let's just get through this one day at a time, one day at a time, one day at a time. And we always stayed busy. So we did a lot of avoiding him. We all played sports, very, very active in sports in our community. And so it was like we'd come home from school, we'd have dinner, we'd go to an extracurricular activity. And we just kind of lived like that. We spent a lot of time at my grandmother's house.
Right. So your siblings, same experience. Any of them get into addiction?
Exactly. So that's why I want to say that I have something weird inside of me. My sister, my two brothers and my sister, very successful, very productive, very happy individuals with marriages and families, careers, children, homes. Not one of them got lost in an addiction in any form.
You know, you never know. Mark, you and I have talked about this a lot. Yeah. We had identical twins on the show.
Yeah.
And one went, became a professor, never used, and the other one became a heroin addict.
Yeah.
So you never know. Even in my family, I always the one got in trouble. My sister never did anything wrong, as far as I know. You know, did you have that kind of stuff?
I did.
I mean, you got three brothers, right?
I have three brothers, and I'm 2 for 4 in terms of, you know, addiction issues. 2 for 4. But, you know, you see that with genetics. Some people get it, some people don't. And did you feel like a void inside when you said you felt different? What was that like? What did you feel?
I love that. Yes, I identify a void. Sure. Always. Just something maybe missing. Actually, what I would call it when I was a young teenager was broken. I just felt broken. And I remember feeling that word, broken. I remember hearing that word in my head. I'm just so broken, just broken.
And that was not necessarily the reality. It was, you know, it's what you thought.
Exactly.
I mean, look, we all play games. My question is, were you embarrassed to have friends come over to your house knowing that if your father was there, it was unpredictable?
So that was a huge struggle for me as a young kid. Yes. Yeah, it was hard.
Yeah. What does that do? I mean, you want to have your friends come over. You can't. I don't know if they say, well, why can't we come to your house? You make up all sorts of excuses.
I had one best friend. And she knew what was going on. Yeah. And Jenny, her and I, she knew what was going on and she was fine, you know. Mm-hmm. But anyone else, it was unpredictable. Mm-hmm. One time I had a neighbor down the street come over and we were playing out on the trampoline. And my dad came out in his underwear and grabbed me by the arm, pulled me in the house in front of everyone.
Oh,
and it was just like that humiliating experience, you know, where we don't want to – can I come over to your house tonight?
Yeah. I know you're laughing now, but it wasn't funny then.
It was not funny. It was painful.
It was painful.
Mm-hmm.
And it stays with you.
The anger that builds up also, because I remember as a young girl – wanting my dad to be better. And I remember wishing, and I'm a Catholic, you know, I have a faith. Mm-hmm. And I remember praying at night and saying my rosary, like, let's make my daddy better, make my daddy better. And then I remember when I crossed the line and the hurt and disappointment became anger and resentment. And I remember stopping wanting him to be better and just being angry that he was that way. And like, you cross that line, the hurt and the disappointment becomes
You're like, protecting yourself, correct?
It just becomes anger. And then I just started retaliating against my father. And I was always the one who would fight him. I'd go tooth and nail with him. Like, that's my personality. You know, I
can see that. Can you
imagine? I remember.
I could, yes.
I wouldn't want to mess with you.
I'd crush his cigarettes at night when he was sleeping. I put thumbtacks in his shoes one time.
Oh, man.
I would retaliate, like, because I just – I couldn't hope anymore. I couldn't hope that it would be
better
anymore.
And you probably couldn't at that age understand or have the tools to learn how to deal with this in some kind of productive way. So you reached out with anger, with doing destructive things yourself, which I don't want to put words in your mouth, but probably this is what was leading up to an addiction.
The unresolved stuff inside. Yes, I agree.
And trying to – oftentimes it's like trying to control the situation or fix it. I'm sure there was a lot of – like by crushing those cigarettes, you were probably thinking like, wow, I'm going to stop him from smoking, right?
He occupied much more attention than a kid ever needed. You know, when you have an unstable parent, they need so much attention, and so much of your life and your focus is on them that there's not a lot of space available in my head for – playing or enjoying or getting to know myself, because it was always my dad had the focus and the attention.
And that's so unnatural. It's not supposed to be on the parent. It should be all on the kids. You know, so, man, that's a rough go.
Yeah, you become a parentified child.
Listen, we got a lot of people that are watching this thing. Listen, can we run through some of them? Bob Moeller, Debbie Reynolds, Judith Lerner. Let's see. Bob Moeller. Hey, guys, just got out of the hospital. Glad to be back. Laura Story. Michael Shoemaker from Tennessee. Bob Moeller. Glad being sober and a spiritual being going through a human existence was what kept me going, and mythology. Laura Story. Blessed to be here with you guys for another Friday's great show, Clean and Sober. Zach Cooper, attorney Zach Cooper. What's up, guys? What's up with you, Zach? Anyway, we'll get to the rest of them. A lot of people, I guess. You're
great.
A big draw, you know what I'm saying?
She is.
Right?
She is. She knows tons of people.
And, you know, you have a great personality. So let's get back to I can't even imagine being in a house with that kind of negative energy going on all the time. How did you deal with it as a kid? I mean – were you afraid to come home from school?
No, I won't say afraid. It was like living on eggshells. So I guess it built in an internal anxiety that has existed, you know, in a very deep place, because you just live with that anxiety of just not knowing what to wake up to, what you're coming home to. But I will tell you that my mother was a super, super stable force. And at the same time that my father was unpredictable and unstable, we had regular dinner routines. We had regular prayer routines. She set things up. She set things up in place for us that allowed a sense of security and stability from my mother, and also emotional support and a lot of love. Never, ever, ever questioned, did my mom love me? Never.
That's great. You know? Listen, if you're joining us now, either on Facebook or other ways, we're talking with Sarah Colvin. And Sarah was in long-term recovery and had a slip and got involved with a lot of very serious crimes. But she's back now. And listen, if you want to talk to Sarah and find out, you know, how she did it, give us a call at 1-888-329-3306.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Sarah. I mean, I knew Sarah and have known Sarah for a long time. And you know, she always had such strong recovery. You know, it's just awesome to have you on the show. So when you were younger, and when did drugs first start coming into the picture? Did it start with pot? Did it feel like the answer?
I was – a big thing for me, I got in a relationship with a 12-year-old boy when I was 12. And I was –
okay. That's okay.
Yeah. I
thought you were going to be saying 20.
No. I was in seventh grade.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you that that became really crucial for me. And when we were 15, he broke up with me. And I was so tied to that relationship as a young child in early adolescence. You're forming who you are and your identity. And I was with this boy. And I think the damage there was pretty severe, because when he broke up with me, I was in ninth grade. I was 15 years old. And I felt like I didn't know who I was anymore.
Was that another incident where another male disappointed you?
Yeah. Yeah, emotionally unavailable.
So you wanted to hold on to this male figure at any cost, and as you said, it was devastating.
It was very devastating. And for me, I didn't start. I think that's one of the reasons why I got into recovery so quickly and why I got so bad so quickly. I was 15 years old. I was at a bonfire and somebody offered me cocaine. And I felt like I found the answer. Like everything that was missing in me was suddenly fulfilled. And I was everything I ever wanted to be. I found in cocaine, like that person who was just happy. I could watch grass grow and be like thrilled with my life. Like I didn't have anything. That void was filled. Mm-hmm. I didn't have anything to fix. I didn't have anything to chase. It was just great being me. And I found that. I found that the very first time I used cocaine, and I dedicated my life to it after that.
Yeah, that's what we all
quickly.
Did. That's what we all did.
Oh, I thought it was the answer. You know, drugs. I mean, I was like, this is the answer to all my problems, you know?
Well, especially if you have low self-esteem and all such other things. We all wanted something to make us feel better. And we still do, but we have to get it in different ways.
Hopefully healthy.
Hopefully in healthy ways. Mark Willig says, hi, Sarah.
Hi, Mark. It's very nice to hear
from you. He knows
everybody.
Okay.
Ed McCash, too. Ed McCash.
Oh, yeah, Eddie.
He's
the man. For sure.
Get that in.
Yeah, so you know, you started dabbling in cocaine. And
I didn't start to dabble.
You didn't
full-blown gone. It was a downward spiral within a year. My life was on the floor. Yeah.
Wow. What kind of damage was it causing you at that point within a year?
When I was 16, I got pregnant with my first daughter, and I had dropped out of high school at that point. I was already running the streets in Kensington, already stealing from everybody I knew, lying to everybody, didn't even care about high school anymore. And then I got pregnant at 16, and my life just, that changed me. And for a whole year, I didn't even do drugs or touch drugs. And I went back to school and I got my driver's license. But it spiraled really, really quickly for me. I didn't spend 15 years smoking weed and drinking. Like when I found cocaine, it was like all in at 15. So by 16, my life was on the ground. Children and youth were involved. I had to go to required classes or mental health treatment.
Yeah.
Wow. At that young age, when you should have been, you know, you should have been a 16-year-old or a 15-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you know, in a lot of ways, you grew up pretty fast. In a lot of ways, you didn't grow up.
Exactly.
Right?
Right. Right. Emotionally.
Yeah.
Yes. I agree with you.
I mean, they do say once you start using heavily, you stunt all your natural progression of growing up mentally, probably even physically for some people. Right. The drugs can do that to you, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And so then you got in recovery for – did you get in – start going to meetings at that point after a year?
My naive 16-year-old mind just said that this baby was going to fix me. It was just another fix. It was just – I was 16, and the hope and expectation that she was going to fix me kept me sober for a year. And then she was born, and I was 17 years old, and it was 1998. And 2 months after she was born – I realized that my expectation was entirely wrong and she wasn't going to love me. I had to love her. And I felt shattered again and disappointed. And being a mom wasn't the answer to fixing me that I thought it was going to be and that I had banked on for a year. And that's what took me back. And that's when I started to find heroin. And it was pretty bad again.
That's some story. I know we have to go to a break.
Okay.
We're talking with Sarah Colvin. And Sarah, when we come back, I'd like to know how you felt. You had a baby. You thought this was going to be the answer to everything. And then it started to crumble again. So when we come back, I'd like to know how you felt, what happened, and what you did about it. And we'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Huntington Creek Recovery Center is Eastern Pennsylvania's premier provider of transformative care for individuals whose lives have been impacted by addiction. Our 40-acre campus offers a tranquil, recovery-focused environment. We specialize in evidence-based care that addresses the effects of trauma and offer a unique program specifically for adolescent males. Huntington Creek Recovery Center can help you achieve lasting sobriety. Call us today at 844-948-2320.
Hi, this is Judy Collins, and I listen to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Hey, we're back, and we're talking with Sarah Colvin, who has had what an interesting life. So before the break, I had asked you what was going through your mind after you had your baby. You thought things were going to be great, and then what happened that it all started to crumble again?
Yeah, that emotional disappointment, I think what it is, you know when we kind of do that, I'll be happy when, and I'll be happy when, and then we get that when, and it's, I'm not happy. And it's that devastation. For me, that's what it was. My Layla was going to be, she was going to fill those empty places inside of me. And this baby was going to make me okay. And being a mom was going to be the joy of my life. And then she was born. And I had no idea what to do with her. I had no idea how to love her or connect with an infant. I'm 17 years old. And that just destroyed me. I think the hardest thing for me was to realize that I thought she was going to love me. I thought that love was going to, she was going to love me. And the hardest thing was when I realized I had to love her. And I felt completely incapable and inadequate in those moments, like totally incapable of being that mother, that love that she needed.
Oh, my goodness, you were a kid yourself, having
right.
a kid.
Yeah.
You know, did you get any help from your family?
Yeah.
You did.
Super, super helpful.
Okay.
My daughter, Layla, she still lives with my mother to this
How
day.
How old is Layla?
She's 23. Oh, she'll be 24
name.
In August.
Yeah, did you get it from the song Layla?
I did not. It's L-A-I-L-A.
Okay. Great name.
Yeah, great name.
Yeah.
I did. I got a lot of help and support from my mother, and that's what my mom does. She's stable, and she's reliable, and she's trustworthy, and kids need that.
Did you feel after you had your child, my fun's gone, I can't go out with my friends, I can't, you know. For that year, you were sober, you were straight. So I guess maybe that didn't. But after whatever started to filter back into you, was it a feeling of I'm missing so much because I have this baby? Did you resent the baby?
I didn't. It wasn't a feeling of – because I never had that. I was never like – I didn't feel like I was missing out. I felt like I had been disappointed, just disappointed that I wasn't going to be fixed by her.
Didn't fill the void.
Yeah, she wasn't going to fill the void. I had to love her. And I just felt inadequate.
Well, it's interesting. Hey, I have another news story I wanted to bring up. And this is so – it's so against our community. When banks ask loan applicants about their arrest records – so the National Community Reinvestment Coalition reports that its valuation of small business loan applications, people that are looking for loans, small ones, from a sample of seven banks in Washington, D.C., revealed that some lenders discriminate against applicants who have been charged at any time in their lives with a criminal offense. Because they feel that we are big risks.
I have recent experience with that.
Discriminatory for sure.
Yeah. I recently have been looking into funding to start an addiction-based eating disorder facility mm-hmm. within our area. And I have felonies. And I have found that small business loans, I'll need a partner because by myself to carry the business and the loan for the business with my felony record is not very likely. And I'll need to do it with a partner. I have recently found that.
Here's the stigma.
There's absolutely the stigma. You know, here it is. You're doing the right thing. You're 4 years clean, all this, and then still struggling to get this kind of loan.
Well, you know, look, our society is so discriminatory with everything, you know, finance, employment, housing, all of it. I think it's changing a little bit some places, but it's when you are discriminated against, it does hurt. And it's like, hey, don't you know, I've been clean. You would say, I'm clean for 4 years. Look at me. You know, it's people don't care unless they're affected by this disease. I do believe that.
And it's funny because like us as recovering people, we know like 4 years is like the most amazing thing in the world. You know what I mean? And they're like, well, 4 years, right? Like the earth people.
Yeah, 4 years.
Yeah.
They don't
They don't get it.
They don't get it.
They don't get it.
And, you know, we've had people in here that have had huge jobs and have gone to jail, and then they get menial jobs because they can't – nobody will give them a second chance. And Mark and I know Mark agrees with me. We believe in second chances, maybe third. And maybe after that it's a problem. But second, we need second chance.
Employment is a huge struggle. I agree with you. I have an MBA degree. I have an undergrad degree in psychology. I've worked in finance before. I've worked in retirement funding. And then in 2011, I got all those criminal charges. And it's been – you talk about menial positions and you talk about not living up to your economic potential. And I understand that. I understand that.
Were these state charges?
State charges. Yes, or I would have
done
state time.
They weren't federal. They were state.
State, yes.
So you know there's a program – are these Pennsylvania charges?
Yes.
So there's a program called Pathways to Recovery in Pennsylvania. After 5 years, either at you know off of probation or parole, you can apply. And it's wiped a lot of records off for a lot of people already. Do you know about that program?
I do not. When I went through drug court, one of the stipulations, so I actually have 45 felony twos. So it was 15 commercial burglaries, but every commercial burglary is tied with three felony charges. I believe instrument of a crime, burglary, and conspiracy, I believe. There were three felonies attached to every single burglary. And one of the stipulations of my drug court was that it will never be expunged. I had to agree to that.
Oh, really? Yeah. Why would they...
So one of the benefits of drug court is that when people finish drug court, their record gets expunged and it no longer carries. And the agreement that I had to sign so that I didn't go to prison for 5 to 10 years.
Oh, that was a deal you made.
Yeah.
You know, that's hard. So
I'll take it.
I know that. No. But I know that. But so they make you sign a deal that you won't help yourself, basically. If you cannot go after a pardon, because you made that deal, it doesn't make one bit of sense to me.
I had 45 felony twos, and they've never experienced. They never let and that somebody like that entering drug court was never known.
Wow.
Now the typical stipulation is 18 to 36 months upstate if you mess up drug court.
Yeah.
So they gave me a 5 to 10 year stipulation.
Oh
like
my
that.
Gosh. So you took it. I get you.
This was a
Listen,
big deal.
I understand
yeah,
why
this was
you,
a huge
anybody
deal.
Would take that. But the thinking on the other side, why would you deprive somebody who could possibly get some of these charges reduced and be able to do more things for the community? For society. I don't understand it. And was it in writing? What would happen if you did go for the pardon?
So that may have just been a drug court that they weren't going to expunge them at the end. Because at the end of drug court, people's charges get wiped away.
The
misdemeanors get wiped away and they don't carry them forward if they successfully complete drug court in Bucks County.
Okay.
However, that may have just been for drug court. It may just be that drug court isn't going to. I've also found recently I was talking with someone who was just looking into wiping away their record. There's also something to overcoming. This is who I am. Mm-hmm. And if you don't want to do business with me or you don't want to hire me, I believe that there's somebody who will.
You have a great attitude, and you know what? To try to get these pardons, it's such a pain. It's such a hassle. Your attitude is probably the right one. Where you know what? I'm going to get what I want legitimately, and it might take a little more. And if you don't like me, I go to somebody else.
If you knew the favor that district attorney Matt Weintraub did for me,
he's a
heart,
good guy.
My heart can't think anything other than gratitude.
Yeah,
it just can't.
He's a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
He gets this.
Fred Harron and with the Bensalem Police Department and Matt Weintraub was the ADA at the time who allowed me into drug court. And I will never, ever, ever have – I just can't have anything but gratitude.
If you're just joining us now, we're talking with Sarah Colvin, was in recovery, slipped, and really went downhill quickly and has come back just as hard. If you need help, call us now at 1-888-329-3306. And if you don't want to call us, call the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. It's a national hotline. There are real people who will answer the phone, and they will absolutely get you some kind of assistance. That's 1-800-662-8255. H-E-L-P. Right, Mark?
Yes. And so you get clean again, right? And you're working really solid recovery for a while, right? You were at going to, I guess, meeting on the mall and some of those other meetings. And
in the 9.5 years.
In the 9
you're speaking
and a half
when
years.
I get clean, yes. At 19 years old.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you're
so
cruising.
We're going
along.
Back now.
We're going back, we're going now, back now. Again. Yes.
So you're okay. Go back.
So, yeah. So then what happened at that point? How did you go back into it?
Okay. A big thing for me was I had a second addiction, a bulimia, an eating disorder addiction. And not all addicts have two addictions, but I was somebody. And so when I had a year or two clean in Narcotics Anonymous, I found recovery for my eating disorder in another fellowship. I went to OA for decades. And that was crucial for me because when I had 8 years clean, I had a really upsetting emotional hurt again from a man, and I relapsed with the bulimia, and that set off a downward spiral for me. And I just want to say how crucial it is to have the yeah. when people who have two addictions, their recoveries go hand in hand. And for me, it took a year and a half in an active bulimia addiction, and drugs became a solution again. Because in that time, you know the life of a using addict, I don't really want to go to meetings when my head's been in the toilet and I'm caught up in addiction again. Yeah. So I pulled away from NA. I started to keep secrets. I didn't want anyone to know. I had 9 years clean and I can't stop binging and purging. I was not going to tell you that in NA. I was not going to come into a meeting. So I put that pretty smile back on. And it's hard. It's hard being dishonest and deceitful to people. So I stopped going to meetings because I didn't want to have to tell you the truth.
Yeah, you know, I think about that sometimes. Yeah. I've been coming out for a very long time. And, you know, I sometimes say, if I went out, how easy or how difficult it would be to admit it? I mean, you yeah. know, it's that, you know, I know it's one day at a time, but you don't want to lose all that time. Yeah. And so is that what was going through? It was easier for you just not to go to meetings so you didn't have to admit it.
Yes.
But then, of course, you're living a lie and blah, blah, blah.
Because right. there's some people who understood that Sarah's in an active addiction right now. It may yeah. just look like food, but she's caught up in obsession and compulsion and sneakiness yeah. and dishonesty. She's caught up right now. Some people recognize that. But some people, I could just say, everything's good. Oh, yeah, the bulimia was bad this week. Like that's not a big deal, you know. And that level of dishonesty, I just can't maintain yeah. it. You just can't maintain that kind of dishonesty. So I just stopped going.
When did this condition start with you? The
I was 15.
Disorder? So you were 15. Mm-hmm. So it was before you got pregnant.
Yes. It was when the boy broke up with me.
That really did it to you, didn't it?
Yeah, that was like a huge emotional devastation. It did. Yeah.
And I remember back you used to have eating plans. And,
yeah, I remember.
You know, she took it seriously.
I meal prepped. Yep. My exercise routine. I was sponsoring women in that fellowship. Yeah. Right.
You know, it's interesting. People, when they hear OA, they think you have to be a certain size.
They do.
But it's, you know, it's such a misconception.
Yes. It is.
It really is.
It's for food addiction.
Food addiction.
I found my solution in Overeaters Anonymous for bulimia. And I found that I have friends that are anorexic and recovering and friends that are also obese and compulsive overeaters only. But there's room for everybody. When you have a food addiction, it can be so, you know, the range.
You know, it's so amazing that humans, they have so many, problems, issues. I think it's indicative of being human that you are drawn to things that make you feel good that are not good for you. I mean, that's everything in life.
Escapism.
But why is everything that's so good
I know.
Not good?
I'm wondering the same thing.
What,
like,
Mark?
I love soda. Like, yeah, absolutely love it. Yeah, drink it in the morning, all that stuff, and it's not good for you. But, like, everything, it seems like, that's, like, really good.
Sweets.
Yes.
Sugar. Alcohol. Narcotics.
Not
things like that are – coping mechanisms. People who are having a bad day, they go to the bar and have a couple drinks. It takes the edge off and they feel better. But with that alcoholic mind, people who go to the bar don't just have a couple drinks. They destroy their life. So we can't use those kind of coping mechanisms the way normal people can.
Well, that's how strong we are, all of us in recovery. We have adversities, and you cannot mask them with bad stuff. So
isn't that the
truth?
We're
super strong.
Mm-hmm. And that's why the power of fellowship is so important.
Yeah, that's fellowship is, you know, Mark talks a lot about isolation, and that's a recipe for a disaster.
It gets so dark in my head, doesn't it, by myself? And the second I let you in, suddenly it's okay again.
Isn't that crazy?
I know. It can spiral into this awful place really quickly. And then once I let you in, it's not so bad anymore. It's not so dark.
And when you're around other people like you, and, you know, we all have the same issues. I mean, similar issues. We feel much better because we're not alone. And the stuff that's going on in our heads, that are doing push-ups.
Well, and, you know, it's crazy because you don't want to get around people when you're isolating. And you can isolate in a room full of people, especially when you have the family background that you were talking about, with having to put on the face that everything was okay and everything wasn't.
It takes courage, doesn't it, to be vulnerable and just say to someone, I'm not okay right now.
Yes, it does.
It does. As a human being, especially as an addict.
Ed McCash says,
Hi,
hey,
Eddie.
Gary, Mark, and Sarah, so proud to call you, Sarah, my friend. Hey, guys, when the weather breaks, we need to have a cigar meeting.
Absolutely,
Ed. Okay, that's cool. And we'll bring Sarah with us.
Yes.
Thanks, Eddie.
Rich Rosenbaum. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Rich.
Larry Good. Hi, Sarah. Love you.
My cap.
That's
go ahead.
My cap. I know how she did it. She didn't do it. She had a spiritual awakening. The man upstairs, who she now knows well, did it.
Our buddy Mike Hep.
Yes, he's a race car driver.
Race car driver.
Keith Larry Hornan. Good is my partner. He is the father of my two children.
Oh, nice.
Larry. Yeah, that's my Larry. That's my boyfriend.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Okay. Keith Hornig. Stephanie DePaul. Let's see who else. We got Mike Hep. All right. Jan Olaf Atterborn is watching.
All right, Gary.
Bill Schiffman is watching.
Whew. Got a lot.
Got a lot of people on here. Okay. So, what was it like, and how did you start to admit that you had a slip? How did you do it?
With the drugs?
Yeah.
I wasn't around Narcotics Anonymous anymore to tell people. And I was 9.5 years clean. I was on a business trip in Costa Rica, and a round of pina coladas came along.
Oh.
And just like that. And I remember sitting next to the person I was with, and I said, I like smoothies. This will be fun.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was exactly what I said. And so I got to tell you, my experience was never the bar. I wasn't a drinker. I got clean at 19 years old. I had never even been to a nightclub, nothing like that. So my experience wasn't alcohol. And what started to happen was I began to tell myself it was a teenage phase. So I was now clean over 3 times the amount of time I even got high for. Yeah. I got high for 3 years as a teenager. I was now clean for 9.5 years. And I also had a lot of degrees and a lot of financial success. And I told myself that I had outgrown addiction.
Yeah.
I had outgrown it.
So you were sitting at a bar somewhere. You've been clean. The drink, you see these drinks. And in a second, your brain said, for whatever reason, I'm going to drink this.
Completely disconnected from the conversation of recovery for 1.5 years also.
Isn't it amazing? Mark,
yes.
It's amazing what your mind can do to you.
It's denial. And you know, if we're not reminded, it's so easy to fall back into that and just think that we're normal.
Within 6 weeks, I was a daily blackout vodka drinker. Within 6 months, I was back on cocaine and heroin. Within 18 months, I had lost my house, lost my car. My daughter had to move in with my mother, sold everything, lost my job, had no money left, drained our savings, her 401k, her college fund. I drained everything, sold everything, all our pawning, all our electronics. I was stealing and ended up in shackles and handcuffs within 18 months.
You know, what you just said sounds like lyrics in a country and western record. You know that?
I never heard of it that way. But
oh, yeah. I lost this. I mean, we're laughing. Yeah. Now. It's not funny. Look how you've come back. I mean, just it's amazing. So, you know, when we're going to go for a break now, and we're talking with Sarah Colvin. And what I would like to know, because I look, we all think of different things no matter how long you've been sober. When you took the drink, you started using again. What made you decide, okay, second time around, I have to be done with this? And how did you get back into the program? You're listening to Clean and Sober Radio, and we will be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
A cancer diagnosis can knock the wind out of you. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health can help. Our brand new Asplund Cancer Pavilion brings you 86,000 square feet of cancer-fighting science for truly comprehensive care. Backed by the strength of an NCI-designated cancer center. Call 1-800-JEFF-NOW. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health. The power to out-science cancer.
Hey, this is Jackie Martling, and I listen to Clean and Sober Radio. This is still Jackie Martling, and you should listen to Clean and Sober Radio. Everybody should listen to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
We're talking to Sarah Colvin, a very fortunate young lady who was clean for many years, went out, did a lot of bad criminal stuff, is back. And, you know, I just found out during the break that she has a book out. Besides everything else she has done positive, it's called Breaking Free by Sarah Colvin. And you can get this book on Amazon, Sarah. Where else?
Amazon.
Well, that's good enough.
You can get it from me personally as well. I have lots of copies if you're local.
Do you have? You want people to reach out to you?
I would prefer Amazon.
Amazon, yeah. Amazon.
I have to do delivery.
So what is this book about?
I was incarcerated.
Yep.
And my mother said, why don't you tell your story? And she said, I know you can do it and I know you have it in you. And so the book is a personal memoir of addiction, recovery, and relapse.
Hey, guys, watching, listening, you got to get this book. I can only imagine how in depth your story is. You know, we just hit the surface while we're doing this, but you know what? It's something that we need to read. It gives hope to people that are still in addiction, because we always talk about there is hope out there. You know, we say there's no drive-thrus, there's no delivery services, but there is plenty of resources out there to get help. And this book, you know, you don't know. Somebody can read this and say, hey, she did it? I can do it.
Breaking Free.
Breaking Free by Sarah Colvin, Colvin, on Amazon.
Thanks, guys.
Is it just paperback?
It's also available as an ebook on Kindle.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay. You know what that is?
I do. I'm a Kindle guy.
I know.
Sounded weird.
Maybe some of the older people watching still know what that is.
The Kindle.
Electronic format.
There we go.
So you have a book out? I mean, all right. So you got clean again 4 years ago. Did you go into a treatment center?
No. I got clean in 2011 when I was incarcerated. And then I was clean for 4 years.
Okay.
And I had a brief a relapse again, and now I'm clean again for another 4 years.
Okay. So 4 years. Mm-hmm. Okay. Plus a lot before that. Okay. Yeah. What's your life like? Do you work?
Yes.
How do you have time to work with everything you do?
So I would love to do more with the book, more speaking engagements, mm-hmm. more advertising with the book. That's really what I would really, really love. Right now we're launching a publication in Richboro by where I live, and I'm the publisher for that. So I'm generating sales for a community magazine we're launching.
Is it connected with recovery, or it's just a regular?
It is not. It is a regular community magazine just for the community. But again, everything about media and writing and publishing. That's me. That's what I enjoy.
You could probably in this magazine each, I don't know how often it comes out.
Monthly
have a section, an inspirational a column with your name on it and give advice to people, because you're qualified to give advice.
I am qualified to give experience. I don't know about advice, but maybe on some areas. One of the features of the book that I get in depth with is that brokenness that was inside of me.
Yeah.
When I was 19 years old and I got clean, there was just this like gaping wound. You know, We all get clean with this like gaping wound. And my experience was that I went through the 12 steps and that wound was no longer so gaping, you know, and it was the process of the 12 steps and the healing that provided that allowed me to be the woman that could, you know, looking to buy a home and have graduate degrees.
Wow.
You know, the process of the 12 steps restored my relationships with other people, my relationships with myself. And so that broken little girl wasn't that 27-year-old woman anymore. So the book really covers my journey through the 12 steps. That's a lot of the book. And then, of course, there's that relapse part.
Is that in the book?
Yes. I wrote the book.
So it's totally on everything in there is – You put your heart out there.
Yeah, big time. I wrote the book in jail when I was incarcerated, and I found Alcoholics Anonymous actually in prison because NA didn't come in very frequently.
Yeah.
And I had been in NA for a long time, and Alcoholics Anonymous scooped me up. They came three times a week into the jail, and they sold me. And I went and got sober in AA for 4 years. I have found them to be strong. The big book had a solid message of recovery. Yeah. I have no like warring with fellowships. You know me. Yeah. I go to OA. I go to NA. No warring with fellowships with me. I love and respect them. So wow. I did. I found recovery again in jail, incarcerated.
Now, did you I know you're into like yoga and meditation and things.
Yeah.
Is that part of your recovery routine?
Yeah. So, yes, it always was. Mark remembers from decades ago.
No,
like,
you know
what was important
I could
to
tell
me.
Because I could see you do like a little bit of the breathing. And I was like, Sarah is still meditating.
Mark and I go way, way back. And,
yes, we do.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny, the things you remember about people. And yes, so I do. I enjoy exercise. I enjoy my meditation time. I do yoga stands very, very frequently. Yes, that was very important. That's the 11th step, right? That's the 11th step when you connect with something bigger than yourself, when you connect with that spiritual part of you that isn't so selfish.
The more that's positive, a good way to put it.
The more positive things you do for you gives you more tools in your toolbox, if you want to do that, to keep you healthy. You
seem
to be very healthy physically and mentally.
Yeah.
And that's what this whole thing's about, is to be able to get back into society and lead a happy, normal, productive, nice person life. Right.
Yeah. To be useful to the people I'm around, to be a benefit to their lives, to contribute to the world, maybe my community, maybe to make sure my kids know they're loved, you know, to have a strong relationship. That's what we want. Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, for people out there listening that are struggling, you know, that maybe had a relapse and back out there, just listen to this story. You can get back. You can get back. Okay. Was there ever a time like when you were out there where you thought, I'm never going to get back again?
I've had multiple of those times. I remember being 17 years old and I used to keep Layla's picture in my car, you know, by the speedometer.
Yeah.
And I remember driving down 95 and the moment I throw her picture out the window, and it was that level of hopelessness, like, I'm going to die this way. And I'm 17 years old. And I remember like those moments where you just give up. And I threw a picture out the window because I couldn't look at her anymore. Couldn't look at her and live this life. And I just thought, I'm going to die this way.
Tell us about Layla. What's your relationship like and what does she do? And
she's amazing.
She's the best.
She's amazing. She's a pharmacy technician at a local hospital. She has a five-year-old. I have a five-year-old granddaughter. Layla's amazing. She is the most resilient child I have ever met. She went through two relapses with me, and the first time she was 11, and to say it was anything but traumatic or devastating. So you have a mom, right? Let's say you have a mom that you only know is in recovery, and you're going on camping trips in NA, and you're going roller skating with your mom, and you know, at the NA events, and you're going to meetings, and everybody's in recovery, and then all of a sudden she's stealing from you, and crazy people are in the house, and she's unreliable, and she's losing her job, and she's not showing up for you anymore. And what that does to an 11-year-old, right?
Yeah.
And Layla and I went through that, and she did not She did not hold that against me when I got sober again at 13. However, she went through a second relapse with me when she was 17 years old. And at that time, she said, I'm not doing it again. And she was strong enough in herself and with my mother that she didn't speak to me for over a year. She did not speak to me. And Layla and I have made multiple ninth step amends together. And I love her. I get to be her mom today. My granddaughter, I get to participate in her life today. She is the strongest, happiest, most beautiful, resilient. I think the word resilient when I think of Layla is she's so resilient, and she has such a good head on her shoulders. She makes responsible decisions for herself and her life. She has good friends. I know. She does the right thing when nobody's looking.
It's all worth it. Your recovery it made this all possible for your daughter. That's really good stuff.
Yeah, so she's great.
Okay. Listen, thank you so very much for coming on this show and pouring your heart out. And you're so bubbly and you're so positive, and it's a great message.
Contagious.
Huh?
It's contagious.
It's contagious.
I feel good.
We all feel really good. So thank you so much. So remember, if you or a loved one is struggling with addiction, help is available. Please call 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-HELP. For Clean and Sober Radio, I'm Gary Hendler.
I'm Mark Sigmund.
Thanks everybody for listening and watching. To learn more about this broadcast, please join our mission on cleanandsoberbroadcasting.com. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Everybody is a star. Hoover rain and shakes the dust of
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
System tries to bring you